basics of this kind of model. And again, I want to emphasize that first, there is a huge amount of detail about the model itself and model validation that I'm skipping in this talk. And secondly, that one recognizes from the beginning that this kind of modeling is extremely simplistic. So far, the cells are isotropic. They have all the same fluctuation. They're mounting on that. That's all right. They all have the same fluctuation amplitude. They have the same fluctuation amplitude, and so on. And
you need it.
Well, that's good, because the metaphor I was going to use is that we knew that the model was highly simplistic. On the other hand, we thought as physicists that it captured at least a few basic ideas like cell membrane fluctuations and differential adhesion, and that therefore it could be useful for certain things. And we said we'd push it until the model broke, and then we might learn something about biology when we saw how the model failed. And somewhat to our surprise, the model has proved extremely elastic, which may not be a good thing. At some level, you might like a model to fail in a definitive. But I'll show you some of that elasticity and what you can do with this kind of model. Okay, so here's a problem that we've been working on now for only a very short amount of time. This is somitogenesis. This is the third phase of embryonic development. We're actually going to move backward in embryonic development a little bit later on, during which the periodic segmental structure of the body is laid down. Before somitogenesis, the body is essentially a stripe. And after, it's interesting, after somitogenesis, what happens if you get water on the lens, obviously. After somitogenesis, you have the recognizable head, tail, and the somites, which are going to go on to form the musculature of the body. And this is work that was done by Nan Chen at University of Notre Dame using the CompuCell. This is work done by one of my students, trying to study the effect of different patterns of cell adhesion on the segmentation process. So this is essentially normal segmentation here, and when you model various kinds of genetic knockouts where you change the behavior of the cell adhesion, you could get this is a subdivision of somites into pairs, a fusion of somites, and so on. Those are all observed experimentally. Okay. People were asking about non-CPM elements of developmental biology. One of the simplest ones to implement is mitosis. Obviously, in many situations, cells grow and divide. In the case of somites, they don't, but there's very little cell division going on. They're One has a control parameter, a phenomenological control parameter, which is the cell volume. If you know that the cell is growing in a particular way, for example, as a result of exposure to nutrients and to growth factors, it's relatively straightforward to write down a simple ordinary differential equation to control the target volume of the cell, and then simply check for critical size of the cell and subdivide the cell into two new cells. You obviously then also have that phenomenologically description of whether that cell division happens in a random direction or whether you have oriented cell division. So that's a relatively simple thing to add. Cells also send signals to each other, in particular chemotaxis. So a cell can secrete a chemical. That chemical can diffuse in the extracellular environment, and the cell can move up or down gradients of the chemical. And there are some classic movies, which I'm hoping I can show you, of that. It disappeared. No. I don't remember the source of this one. I have this one off the web, and I don't remember the source. These are neutrophils that are chasing a chemoattractant, and what they're doing is they're taking a micropipette, you can see the micropipette, with a chemical that the cell likes, putting down a little blob of it, and watching the cell respond. So let me play it again. So that's what chemotaxis looks like. Again, it's a cell on a substrate. And then there's the even more famous neutrophil movie of the neutrophil chasing the bacterium. This is the neutrophil, this is the dot, is the bacterium. Those are red blood cells. And I don't know whether you root for the bacterium or for the neutrophil.
It's like
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I personally feel more sympathy for the neutrophil that keeps getting but it gets it, man.
This was made in 1950.
Yes, I have that one. I have the it's a sort of one of the great dramatic classics in biology.
And if you go up to the same one, you know that they were
there's a choice. Yes, he doesn't choose.
It's the only time it ever happened that it was caught on film.
Munch. Okay. So, that's interesting, the gender of the neutrophil and the bacteria.
You assume it's female, you assume it's she.
Or maybe the bacterium is female and the neutrophil is male, I don't know. I think the bacterium has to be male because it's devious. Okay. So that's the basic phenomenon. To implement this, you need to have a chemical field. The typical behavior of the chemical field is that the field diffuses, there will be some decay, extracellular decay. This may depend on local situation. As we heard yesterday, the presence of other chemicals can cause accelerated decay. The extracellular matrix can bind the chemoattractants on secretion terminal. The simplest thing that you can do is to assume that the velocity of the cell is linearly proportional to the gradient of the chemical concentration. That works all right under certain circumstances. It has obviously some some pathological situations in the sense that when the gradient of the chemical is very strong, the cell can't move infinitely fast. The first order correction for that is to use a Michaelis-Menten type formalism for the gradients. So put in the energy. One of the nice things, though, that's important is that since if you assume that the velocity of the cell is basically proportional to some function, which is a gradient of some function of the chemical concentration, that is, the chemical concentration basically behaves like a potential energy with a chemical potential, then you can just add your function of the chemical concentration to your energy, and the cells will chemotax. And that makes life very simple.
Does
yes?
Does the cell move randomly without you breathing?
Yes, it does. And they do. Well, it's, yes, approximately.
For E. coli,
there's a lot. Of course, E. coli moved by run and tumble, the chemokinesis. If you want to put in chemokinesis, you have to do a little bit more work because you have to put in basically an auto. Inertial terms are, I don't have inertia in here. Inertial terms are represented as constraints on the autocorrelation of velocity.
I have a question regarding this. I have followed it for a few years, but in case of Dictyostelium, thymol, in response to cyclic AMP concentration, biochemically speaking, all the receptors are already supposed to be saturated by cyclic AMP concentration. Yet, Dictyostelium obviously chemotaxed.
Yes.
And we people were arguing why. What's related to this? You know, you only put in the direct, you know, concentration gradient.
Right.
In other words, the DT or the, you know, concentration of Bohr.
Well, Dicti, in the case of Dicti, they respond to time variation in the concentration.
Yeah.
And, I mean, bacteria basically do the same thing, depending on how much you believe about the ability of bacteria to really measure spatial gradients, but typically the assumption still is that the bacteria primarily measure temporal gradients and adjust the time between tumbles response to that. Those are all important in particular models, but as long as the net effect is that your cells move up the gradient, you're relatively independent of the details here. And I'll show you that in a minute. We'll do Dicti at the end if I get to it. So this is just implementing this is very simple. You can just do a forward Euler diffusion if you like. There are a variety of issues with chemotaxis and how to implement it. There are some numerical instability problems with chemotaxis if you have moving boundaries. The chemical field is typically attached to the lattice. If you think of a two-dimensional situation in which your cells are on top of a substrate, where the diffusion is happening with substrate, that's reasonable. In 3D, obviously you have excluded volumes, which are problematic. In fact, for many cases it doesn't matter, but one does have a variety of different approaches to implementing chemotaxis in these kind of models. This is the heading for that movie that I showed. David Rogers from Vanderbilt, 1950s.
Do you have non-uniform diffusion implemented?
You mean anisotropic diffusion?
No, not uniform. Like for instance, if you've got tight junctions in an epithelial tissue, you're not going to be getting much passing through that tissue.
The answer is that so far we haven't done models where that is important. There's no reason that you can't implement that. This is a rotten movie of the neutrophil chasing the bacterium from a simulation point of view. And what we've done here is we've created basically little fluid particles so you could see what the velocity of the cell was. And it's possible, actually, to build a whole Navier-Stokes simulator by discretizing your lattice, associating the concentration field with the lattice with the fluid particles rather than with the lattice. You can go off lattice. And this is sort of a hybrid between the finite element method and this POTS approach. It works pretty well. You can actually write down the whole Navier-Stokes equation, even with the inertial term, if you like. This doesn't look particularly like the Navier-Stokes equation that you know and love, but it is. This is the advection term of the Navier-Stokes equation. Just forward Euler diffusion.
What is the B? What's the parameter B stand?
D here is the separation between the centers of mass of the fluid particles. We published this in Physical Review if anybody's interested. You can do Poiseuille flow. You have some problems at the boundary, but you get a pretty good parabolic fit. The discretization here is extremely coarse, so you could look at the diffusing fields for moving sources. You can look at diffusion to be in the presence of a flow. This is diffusion. This is diffusion with Poiseuille flow. This is just Poiseuille flow with no diffusion. And you can see you get steps which result from the discretization. Not of the lattice dot, but of the fluid particles, which are bigger than that. Cells move. For example, during gas relation, cells move a heck of a lot. There's a beautiful quotation by Walter that it's not birth or death, it's gastrulation that's the most important event of your life. And this is a step earlier in development. I showed you somitogenesis, where you form the posterior and anterior structures of the body. This is where the actual body axis is formed. We heard about it yesterday, also the germ layers. And what happens in somitogenesis is quite remarkable. This is a chick embryo. The head's going to be here. The tail's going to be here. And what you see is this wonderful spiral vortex motion where the cells move actually more than the whole size of the embryo. This is a dye where we've put a trail in. It's basically superimposed images. So that the
dye plus.
Basically, the length of this stripe is the velocity. You can see what happens. There's a lot of work that's been done on modeling this. There's a beautiful paper that scooped us rather badly by Case Weir and Bakhtiar, where they modeled all sorts of different situations. There's also some nice work that's been done by Tim Newman at Arizona State University on this. But essentially, there's a structure here called Henson's node. There's some information that's known about the secretion of chemorepellent and chemoattractants, and it's possible then to, and this isn't, this one I also have to end, it doesn't play on this. What you'll see is happening is that the adhesion of the cells is causing Henson's node to drag what this group of cells back here called Kohler's sickle are being dragged along with it, and that creates a recirculation vortex on the sides that gives rise to the spiral motion.
Why does it keep going down?
There's a chemorepellent here and a chemoattractant here. Actually, very little is known about the sources of chemoattractants and chemorepellents in this kind of structure. And I'm very interested in making those measurements, and so I've been working on some technology to do that. Again, a lot of times, modern molecular biology is incredibly powerful. You can manipulate single, you can detect and manipulate single molecules beautifully. You move 3 inches away from what you can do with modern technology, and there is nothing to help you make the measurements. So if you ask the question, what are the genes that are being expressed in this region of Henson's node? No problem. If I ask you, in the extracellular matrix at this location, what's the concentration of FGF4? Forget it. So a lot of the parameters that you need to measure for this kind of modeling are not measurable with current technology. The ones that are measurable haven't been. Okay, all right. obviously interacting signals create patterns. People here are probably familiar with the Turing equations, where you have two coupled reaction diffusion equations with nonlinear couplings, F and G, with the correct signs for the partial derivatives, and with the diffusion constant of the inhibitor greater than the diffusion constant of the activator, initial uniform situation becomes unstable to a spot pattern. This is basically a little slide showing the mechanism there. Basically what happens is where the activator is above the inhibitor to begin with, the activator goes up to a saturation peak. Because the inhibitor diffuses faster, out here you have more inhibitor than activator, so you can't build a peak of activator there. So there's a region of excluded volume around the peak, and so you get spots then at some typical wavelength away. And there are beautiful models, for example, by Philip Maney and Stuart Newman studying these kinds of activator inhibitor models. So this is real classic PDE modeling of developmental pattern. The big problem with this kind of modeling is that it doesn't include cell movement. If you want to do this kind of modeling in a lot of developmental phenomena, cells move, you have to solve reaction advection diffusion equation. Makes life much harder.
How does one know that it's this process which gives rise to these patterns?
You don't. This is the artist fallacy. But in fact, almost all what's happening is not reaction diffusion. What's happening is that the cells are absorbing and secreting things in particular ways. And so mostly what happens extracellularly is decay of the chemical and diffusion, and maybe sticking of the chemical to the extracellular matrix. There's relatively little interesting biochemistry going on extracellularly. Most of what's happening is inside the cells. What's interesting about this model of fish is that in Turing instability, the wavelength of the instability is set by the diffusion constants. If you look at the cover, say, of Murray Mathematical Biology as a picture of a leopard, the leopard starts out as a little embryo, lays down a spot pattern, and then the thing grows, and the spots grow isotropically because the pattern's frozen in. In these angelfish, the stripes move. The wavelength of the pattern stays the same. As the fish grows, the stripes move on the body. So this is actually a better example of diffusion turn. Okay. Obviously, there's a question about how you lock in this kind of pattern. Obvious, and what happens, of course, is this was the question that was asked. Well, we call it reactor diffusion, where reactions are occurring inside cells rather than extracellularly. In a lot of cases, the inhibitor is not identified. That's sort of a secondary thing. And there's a question of how you lock in these patterns that are intrinsically evanescent. Cells differentiate. Typically, our modeling of cell differentiation is extremely primitive. You read in a paper that if cell X is exposed to growth factor Y, it differentiates in way Z. And you write down either a deterministic or a stochastic implementation of that. One would like to have more detailed models of genetic regulatory networks and their response to external signals. And Yi Zhang, in one of the papers that she put out there, has models of that kind for tumors. The big problem, as always, with those kinds of pathway models that we were hearing about yesterday, where you're doing reaction kinetics, is you need lots and lots and lots of reaction kinetic constants. And again, most of them aren't available. So instead of putting in a lot of parameters that we don't know, we just put in a phenomenological description. Because again, the goal of this kind of modeling so far has been primarily to say, given a set of cell behaviors, what happens in pattern? There's a tendency for people to say, well, if you have a lot of parameters, you can get anything. That's not usually true. To reproduce observed phenomenology at the cell, at the tissue level, given cells with given behaviors, is actually quite hard. Not trivial. Okay. We've worked for a long time on avian limb development. This is the outgrowth of the wing bud and the leg bud, which eventually gives rise to this bump. The bump then has a set of what are called chondrogenic, that is cartilage developing condensations inside of it. You get something that looks like this. This is a section through the limb. Eventually you're going to get the bone pattern of the limb. These are mesenchymal cells. So when they come together to form a cluster, it's called mesenchymal condensation. There is are a lot of biological processes where you have what are known as epithelial to mesenchymal and mesenchymal to epithelial transitions. And so the cells basically go from being more or less isotropic to being polarized, and then they may go back to being isotropic again. That happens during somatogenesis. It happens here during limb development. To simplify things, we do these experiments in vitro. You take the developing limb, you chop it off. You take the mesenchymal cells, you plate them out on a substrate, and you find that they produce fibronectin, which is a glue-like substance. They deposited, in this case, a two-dimensional substrate. They random walk on the substrate. And it's also known that if a cell sees enough fibronectin in its environment, it starts expressing cell-cell adhesion molecules, so the cells stick together. And here's a simulation of that process. It's actually a three-dimensional simulation of this process. And you see that an initial random distribution leads to a patterning instability. This patterning instability glues itself down to the substrate, because eventually there's so much fibronectin the cells can't move anymore. And
this is a cross-section of the 3D, or
it's a top view. This is a 3D simulation of cells in a dish. So it's sort of a 2.5-dimensional simulation, if you like. The cells could crawl over each other, but they don't do that very much. They mostly stick to the substrate. And you can do experiments. These are now going to be fairly old, where, for example, transfect the cells with constitutively expressed fibronectin, so they produce too much fibronectin. And then you get bigger aggregates and they blob together like this. You could simulate that. And you could look at the distribution of blob sizes as a function of fibronectin production, initial concentration of cells, and so on, and build a little phase-space diagram of the morphologies that you get with the simulation, and compare that then to the experiment. This is actually simulations that Nico did. You could run these. This simulation you could run on our computers here. If you download it, you've got this simulation on the web, so you can play with it. Okay. Trying to put it into the limb is something we've had a little more trouble with. There's a lot of signaling that goes on in the limb. There's a structure at the end of the growing limb called the apical ectodermal ridge. The posterior, where your armpit is, there's another signaling center called the zone of polarizing activity. There are a number of signaling molecules involved, so you have to do a lot of simplifications there. Unfortunately, a lot of the regulatory pathways and signaling pathways are not known. And we know that FGF4 is important. We know it signals through the non-canonical limb pathway, but the details of that and how these pathways interact are not mapped out. You go to KEG database and look for the signaling pathways, and you don't get much. There's a sketch of what may be going on. This is, goodness, that's a good question. This is chick, but mouse is fairly similar. I believe the there's a lot more going on than this. So again, you basically here are going to take this idea that you have certain kinds of up and down regulation. You're not going to model the signaling network in detail. There are issues about the zone of activity where cells are proliferating and highly migratory, because that changes in time. A couple of years ago, we wrote down sort of a cheat, which was a PD model of what was known about the reactions between the signaling molecules. This is just a pure PD model. I use that to generate creep patterns and regulate cell adhesion. Cell adhesion to substrate and cell and mitosis, and this won't show for some reason on this computer, but you can, if you go online, you can see the growth of this pattern where you start out with this array of cells here. The cells align themselves with a chemoattractant field here. That creates a fibronectin field here, and the cells then condense and form this trifurcated structure. Nico has been looking at problems of limb outgrowth, so this is obviously in a fixed rectangular geometry, which is not so interesting. You'd like to be able to do it in a three-dimensional structure. This is Nico's little simulation. He doesn't have condensation here, but he is having the AER secrete a growth factor. The growth factor induces cell proliferation. As you were saying, in this case, it's clear that you're getting alignment of the cell boundaries along the third directions of the underlying lattice. It's possible to get rid of that at the cost of making your simulation slower. This was just this is a toy simulation, so we weren't too worried about it. This is a 3D simulation, but it's a 2D section. Cells can change shape. This has been a little bit more serious in terms of trying to agree with experiment. This is a model of vascular development that was developed by my former postdoc Roland Merz, trying to understand what the fundamental processes are in vascular development, angiogenesis. And there's a particular question which is interesting, which is, as I was talking about with some people the other day, vasculogenesis and angiogenesis are quite different. Rather surprisingly, in the embryo, the vascular system develops as an initial random network. You distribute vascular endothelial cells throughout the tissue. They reach out, hook onto whatever is nearby, form a random network, and then they develop into little capillaries. And it's only later, when you have blood flow through that capillary network, vessels where there is a lot of flow grow, vessels where there's little or no flow shrink and disappear. And you go from something that looks basically like random three-dimensional chicken wire to the branch structure that we're used to. That's very different from sprouting angiogenesis, which occurs, for example, in wound healing or tumor development, where you have existing blood vessels that send out branches. There are some beautiful models of both of these phenomena, but there haven't been any models that were able to do both at the same time. And since the cells that are involved are the same, and the behavior of the cells is the same, you would like to be able to build both phenomena from the same model. Okay. This is a movie that was made by Roland. Roland is definitely a theorist. This is showing what is called HUVEC culture on Matrigel. What they've taken are human umbilical vein endothelial cells. Human umbilical vein endothelial cell. They plated them out on a substrate of a rather ugly substance which has lots of growth factors in it. And what you can see happening here is that they align themselves into what are called cords here, and form what's called a primary vascular plexus. And if you look very carefully, these polygonal domains evolve in time. Small domains shrink and disappear, large domains grow, and although it's hard to see it in this movie, if domains get too big, they can actually subdivide. So that's the basic phenomenon. There is
there's
some
no flow here, right?
Sorry?
There was no flow.
There's a little bit of flow because they have to keep providing nutrients in the medium, but there's essentially not.
It's only just cells.
The cells are all attached to the substrate.
They don't align to tubes or so through which they could be.
No. There's no blood flow. This is before the formation of blood, the capillaries. Okay. This is a photographs of experiment. This is a model of Gappa and Serini, where they basically just assume that cells, this is a PD model, they assume that cells chemotaxe in response to a secreted chemical, VEGF-A. And there's some good experimental data, basically where you do cell tracking and look at VEGF-A concentrations and show that they move up those gradients. And it's possible to write down a PD model based on that. This is a chemotaxis term here. This is a diffusion term for the chemical concentration. The cells themselves diffuse. This kind of model can be translated immediately into a POTS model simulation. There are a couple of things that are peculiar about the Gamma and Serini model. One of which is that the cells accelerate in response to the chemical field. It's dV/dt here. So it's an acceleration term, not dx/dt. And we know that we're in the viscous limit, so cells shouldn't be moving according in a Newtonian way. So that's a little bit funny. The other thing about this model that's peculiar is that you get this nice picture, and then they stop. And you ask Gamba and Serini, why did you stop then? And they say, well, because the picture doesn't look right after that. And you might expect that, in fact, this kind of continuum modeling would fail rather badly, because the structures you're looking at are on the scale of a cell. And to approximate the distribution of cells by a continuum limit, when you're looking at structures that are the size of one cell, is iffy. Anyway, we took this model, translated it into POTS model, and this is what you get. These are cells that secrete a chemoattractant. The little green lines are iso concentrations of the chemoattractant. And the cells blob up into little balls. Let me play that again. And we talked to Avner Friedman from Ohio State, and he said, well, actually, years ago, I proved that if you just have chemoattraction and secretion, auto-chemoattraction, then you get blobs. Nothing else can, there are no other solutions. So much for that. Well, then we said, it's known that these cells also secrete, have on their surfaces a cell adhesion molecule, VE cadherin. And that if you knock out the VE cadherin, instead of getting a vascular network, you get blobs. So we said, okay, we didn't have cell adhesion in our model. Let's put cell adhesion in our model. And here you put cell adhesion in the model. Let's see, why is it not playing? Interesting. Try that again, there we go. And this looks a little better, but it's very slow. And having just warned you not to say that patterns should look like other patterns, while you can almost never conclude that the fact that two patterns look the same means that the mechanisms are right, if two patterns really don't look the same, you've probably got the wrong mechanism. And so this is what you get. It's not too bad, but it's not quite right. Then we looked a little bit more, and we discovered that VE cadherin, as you heard yesterday, cell adhesion molecules are not just adhesion molecules, they're also receptors. So when you have binding of cell adhesion molecules, they send a signal to the cell, and the cell can change its behavior. This is nature having a criminal mind. You'd like to be able to modify one thing at a time. So you'd like to be able, for example, change cell adhesivity or cell motility and not change anything else. Whenever you go in biochemically and change one thing, you change all sorts of things which you have left, which you would not, don't want to change at the same time. And in particular, it's known that in when you have VE cadherin binding, it results in a reduction of VEGF-A response at the surface where the binding occurs. And so basically what happens is that you have contact inhibition of motility. If two cells come together in response to VEGF-A signaling, once they come into, once they touch each other, they stop moving in response to VEGF-A. And so we put that into the model. That's looking a lot better. Now you'll notice you're getting refinement where the domains shrink and disappear. You're also getting some domain splitting if this thing will play through. Don't know why it's not. Yeah, that guy there was just split. That guy's going to split. Okay. That's much closer to what's really happening.
What if you keep on running this one?
It basically stays the same. You get a steady state where you get shrinking of domains and subdivision of domains. And that's pretty much correct. The kinetics is still a little bit screwed up. So we've got this VE cadherin knockout phenotype. As I like to say, modeling of this kind is usually very good at post-dicting things. It's not yet very good at predicting things.
But the knockout, the problem in there is even worse because in vivo, when you knock out one gene, you're changing the whole organism. So you kind of use that as a assume that when you are knocking out a gene, you just modify one thing.
No, but it's a selective knockout which you can trigger only at if you simply do it, you have to be able to induce the knockout.
Yeah, but that is how
absolutely.
Way we believe in knockout is funny because. You know, I don't know, but nobody ever goes and look and make sure that that animal is exactly the same thing as the other, except with
that's
that
right.
molecule. And I'm sure it's not.
Knockout experiments are very rough things to do. As I said, there's almost.
Can you? This is essential binding, as I talked about this morning. Can you just introduce competitive some ligand? You know.
Absolutely, you'd like to use an antibody to block VE cadherin.
Or it's a head of the cadherin.
I didn't do the experiment, so all I've got is the publication,
mm-hmm.
published data on the knockout. I'm not going to show you the quantitative data on the kinetics here.
Well, I have a question regarding that simulation. They ended up in the right size of, smallest blood vessels, capillaries.
Yes.
And originally it was a little thicker, and it appeared to be like capillary network, the right side.
Yes.
And one side cell hanging out here and moved to the other, coming out, just like a paper, we call pericyte.
Yes.
You know, coming in and out.
Yeah.
Is that how they know, this size?
The size is fixed by the mobility of the cells, the size of the cells, and the diffusion constant and decay constant of the VEGF-A. Some of those things are measured, are known experimentally, and some aren't. And there actually is, I'll show you the last picture, and I'll come back to that. The temporal behavior of this is still not very good. One key thing that we've left out here is that our cells are still isotropic. They're round. Endothelial cells are, in fact, highly elongated.
Right.
And so we put that in. It's a little bit of a mess, but you can write a constraint on the moment of inertia and the inertia tensor. And it's actually possible to make this local. What you really don't want to have to do is every time you flip a spin, diagonalize an inertia tensor. That's a really bad thing to do. And so these simulations were, by the way, all done in 2D because this is easy. You can do this in 3D, but it gets to be a mess. And this is what happened. And this is now getting to be pretty good from the point of view of the quantitative kinetics. Those two guys really look at that and have a hard time. You can actually then compare in a little bit more detail what's happening to the morphology. You can study the effect of cell elongation. In this case, we haven't put in the contact inhibition. We've just put in cell elongation. So you turn off cell elongation, you get blobs. As you have elongation, you get a vascular pattern. There are ways of quantifying these things by basically counting branch points, lacunae, the relative sizes of domains, and so on. We really do lack. If a mathematician. Apply mathematician asking, what is the single thing we need the most? I would say a set of metrics that allow us to compare cellular patterns of this kind and labyrinthine patterns. There are no good metrics that allow me to take an image of this kind, take another image, and tell me whether those images are in fact the same. By eye, you know how to do it. Quantitatively, if I just look, for example, at the distribution of domain sizes, that's not enough. I can have two patterns that are completely different with the same distribution of domain size.
What about two-point correlation or three-point correlation?
Doesn't do anything. Nothing.
Microstructure control materials, that's what they do.
Yeah, but it's useless. The reason they do two- and three-point correlation functions is that if you have a material where you can't see the domains and you do scattering, that's what you can measure. But that you're throwing away all the structural information that you need. There isn't a good way to compare this. And when you go to labyrinthine patterns, if I stripe this stuff out and twist everything up, really nothing to do. Very, very hard problem. The only person I know who's really done interesting things on it is Gamanu Gunaratne at University of Houston. Hard problem. Okay. But if we just look at the number of lacunae and number of nodes, this is simulation experiment. Again, you have one free parameter, which is the time scale of the experiment to the simulation. In principle, you should match that with the diffusion constants of the individual cells. And we've done that, not in this picture, but later on. Works quite well.
Don't you have the soft diffusion equations in this thing for you?
Yes.
Don't you already, at this point, basically fix this thing?
No, because there's another parameter, which is how many diffusion steps, the ratio of the diffusion constant is run as a certain amount of diffusion per Monte Carlo step. So the diffusion constant has the diffusion time for the chemical definitely has units associated with it, but you still have to have the diffusion constant for the cells in the simulation, which is measured in pixel elements, which are real space per Monte Carlo step.
There's no problem that there's two diffusion processes happening at the same time. They somehow have to match it. One thing has to be twice as fast, let's say, in the model just as well as in simulation. You don't have as much feeling there.
We don't have the experimental data in that data. But yes, I mean, in principle, you can do the experiments to measure all of these things. It's a question of actually doing the experiments. And the last thing I wanted to show you is the sprouting angiogenesis. This is now, again, with the contact inhibition rather than the elongation. but you start with a blob of cells, and it grows out. It grows out the capillaries. So in fact, you can get, depending on your initial condition, sprouting angiogenesis or vasculogenesis with the same model. Okay, I want to talk about a couple of other things quickly. Excitable media. There are all sorts of wonderful models for oscillatory signaling. Everyone loves the dictyostelium discoideum. I guess Herbie is probably going to come up here and talk at some point in the 3 months we're here. There are lots of both PDE and ODE models for oscillatory signaling of cyclic AMP and dictyostelium discoideum. Things like Fitzhugh-Nagumo equations, which give rise to structures that look like cardiac arrhythmias. These are very detailed models of the heart from Sasha Panfilov at Utrecht. This is the Fitzhugh-Nagumo equations generating a plane spiral and a chaotic spiral here. This is movies of Stan Murray, also at Utrecht. So those are nice periodic oscillations associated with tachycardia, in which case you feel really bad, but you don't die. And on the right, you have fibrillation, where you do die. Basically the same underlying model. It's a reaction diffusion model. And then what I always end, I always end these talks with these beautiful simulations of the Utrecht group using the POX model. I'm always very jealous of not having done. This is the simulation of the aggregation and culmination of dictyostelium discoideum. Dicti are a unicellular slime mold. They're eukaryotes. They eat bacteria. They normally live in the soil. And in the soil, they don't form nice patterns, particularly during aggregation. If you put them in a dish, this is a bad reproduction of a experimental image. But they first form these spiral waves, then the spiral waves break apart into streams, and you form mounds. The mounds then develop into a slug. The slug migrates where it finds a place that it likes. It then differentiates into a stalk and a fruiting body on the top. People like this first because the spiral waves are reminiscent of Veliusov-Zavitinsky spiral wave chaos. Secondly, biologists like it because it's a model of the development of multicellularity. This is a video of the actual experimental spiral waves here. And what do these cells do? Well, they stick together when they come into contact with each other. They chemotax in response to cyclic AMP, actually do. Time variations in cyclic AMP concentration. And the way they do this, what they do when they get is the following. If a cell is sitting there, it sees a pulse of cyclic AMP go by, it moves towards the source of the pulse, and it sends out a pulse of cyclic AMP itself, called relaying. And then it has a refractory period where it doesn't do anything for a short period of time. And that's what you need. You need chemotaxis, relaying, and cell adhesion. And you put that together, and now this movie doesn't want to play. Come on. Played fine a few minutes ago. Well, we're going to have to get these to play because. Without these pictures, there's no fun. We've listened this long, you've got to get the pretty pictures in. Okay, here we go. see if we can play it directly. There.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the spiral. This, the problem here is that the number of cells, this was a simulation done by Nick Saville, one of Pauline Hardwick's students about 10 years ago. And this was about the biggest thing you could simulate at that time. See the spirals and then the breakup into streams. Beautiful. Nothing in there except adhesion, chemotaxis, and relay. What's really impressive, though, is that's a three-dimensional movie, is what happens next. There is gravity.
There is?
They put gravity. Gravity is really easy. The gravity, there's a little bit of a cheat. Gravity isn't vertical, it's at a 45 degree angle. What?
It's on a hill.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just symmetrical, it just sits there. You've got to have a little bit of asymmetry to knock that. But what's impressive, really, to me, is this guy is crawling around. There's no central organization there at all. There are self-sustaining spiral waves that are induced in this cigar-like structure that are caused by relaying chemotaxis and adhesion. They cause peristaltic contractions in this slug that cause it to crawl around. This looks an awful lot like a slug with a nervous system. You have three basic physical mechanisms there. That's it. Nothing else. You know exactly what you put in. People spent years worrying about what kind of very complicated things are going on to organize this behavior. You don't need them. All you need are adhesion, chemotaxis, and relay. They've even shown later on that these things are phototactic. There are no photoreceptors in these, but when you look in the Goldbetter equations, there are certain chemical reactions that are light sensitive. If you upregulate those in your Goldbetter model, these things phototax.
What's the difference between the yellow ones and the...
Okay. The cells are going to become, later on, pre-stalk cells. These are pre-stalk and pre-spore cells. When the thing differentiates, it's going to produce a stalk and a spore body on top.
Yeah, but the spore body would be spread throughout the stalk.
That's something that is not included in this model. The adhesivity of the pre-stalk and pre-spore cells is slightly different, and if you include that, which is not included in this model, the pre-stalk cells move to the front of the I published a paper on that with Herbie years ago. I published a paper on that with Herbie about the segregation of the pre-stalk cells to the tip of the slug. Here, there's no difference in behavior of the yellow and the green cells.
When they start out, though, before they start the stalking, aren't the cells essentially all the same type?
There's a lot of debate in the literature about exactly when the differentiation happens. The cells are all sending out signals to each other saying, "Become stalk." No one wants to become stalk because you die. Everyone wants to become spore. On the other hand, if everybody becomes spore, then everybody dies. And so this is one of these evolutionary traps. And there is a lot going on. One of the things that happens is the stalk cells are at the front of the slug, and they sort of steer where it goes. So there's sort of a tacit agreement here that the guys who die get to pick where everybody goes. I don't want to anthropomorphize too much. None of that's included in this.
Okay. Size of these, population.
This simulation is much smaller than the real thing.
Right.
The number of cells in this slug is about 1/50th the number in a real slug. But you could scale it up. The problem here was actually computing limitations at the time when this was done. Now, let's show the last one. But what's wonderful here is that the behavior of these cells hasn't changed. depending on your initial condition, you get spirals, streams, slug, mound, slug crawling. Same cells, no change in behavior. Now, they add to their model differentiation, where the stock pre-stock cells start differentiating into stock, and you start with the right physical configuration. And this is now the simulations of Stan Murray. So the red cells are pre-stock, the gray-blue is stock, the red cells are differentiating into stock, basically they die and vacuolate. The blue cells are pre-stock AB cells, and I don't want to go into the details of the biochemistry of the differences there. But basically what's happening here is that the pre-stock and pre-spore cells are doing the same thing that they do in the slug, and they're functioning as a peristaltic pump that's pumping the stock out. Yeah. And of course, when you run out of the pre-stock cells, which are the cells that are chemotaxing the most strongly, the chemotaxis waves stop and the whole thing freezes up.
Yeah, but where does the fruity pump?
Sorry?
Well, doesn't that, I mean, there's more to this story, isn't it? Doesn't this, the tip start spitting these spores out?
No, it doesn't do anything. It just waits
until
something
the
bumps
doesn't, but in. The
no, they just, you wait, they sit there till something bumps into them.
Is that, that's kind of funny, because I thought Offmer seemed to indicate that these guys, that there's some kind of mechanism that causes them to maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you could be right that the spores insist and they're for and become less cohesive, and eventually the fruiting body falls apart. Yeah, they don't have any differentiation here of the spores. I mean, I've done the experiment in my lab, and the little guys make their stalks and they sit there for as long as I've watched them, but that isn't that long.
Okay.
But this is the thing that really inspired me to go back and be more serious about these things, because they've basically got 90% of the life cycle of this organism nailed down. And there isn't very much there. I mean, you've got basically five or six differential equations to go through the whole life cycle. Everything depends on initial conditions. And they're pretty little things, like the taper of the stalk here. See, it tapers in, then gets fatter again. That's observed experimentally. The shape of the stalk inside the fruiting body is correct. So there are a lot of little details that you would never put in by hand, but this thing gets right. And they're basically the result of surface tension effects as the things form. So I think that's a very beautiful result. I wish I had done it. But I didn't.
In that picture that you just had, the experimental back, no, the other, back to the.
Yeah, sorry. If it'll let me. No.
Oh, can I ask a question?
Yeah, well, you can ask a question while the computer is deciding whether it's going to crash. No, you have to be a little bit careful about the quality of your random number generator. If there are terrible correlations in your random number generator, you can get pathological effects in this kind of Monte Carlo. From a practical point of view, those don't happen. If you ran this simulation many times, you might find that individual cells were in different positions in the final aggregate. But the global behavior of the formation of the slug and the crawling of the slug, the differentiation into stock and fruiting body is going to be the same. So this is again a situation where the microscopic details are very sensitive to perturbation, but the global behavior is extremely robust. it better be robust, because they had to guess something like 15 parameters, 20 parameters, to get this to work. And what's amazing about it is that it worked the first time. This is a simulation that actually worked the first time they ran. Okay, well.
Yeah. Oh, my another question is that you mentioned that the simulation results actually depends on the initial condition.
Yes.
And also, you know, the best setup. So it's like a kind of different view of the feeling of phenomena, because many phenomena people will think that the steady state is more important. Like you started from actually initial condition.
Yes.
Because of the mechanics, and you get some steady state which makes sense. Now you are the simulation framework says the initial condition actually determines the final state.
Well, again, when you talk about a final state, you have to be careful. In the case of the fruiting body, you do reach a physically static steady state. In the case of the slug, if you have say periodic boundary conditions, that slug will just keep crawling around forever. So you're never in what would consider to be a thermodynamic equilibrium. You're simulating things. The motility of the cells requires an energy input, so the fluctuations are non-thermal in origin. The relaying of the cells requires an energy input. If you turn the relays off, everything just turns into a blob. Nothing very interesting. And as somebody said earlier, I mean, we're using the Monte Carlo method in a totally invalid way. I mean, we're not doing ensemble averages. We're not looking at equilibrium states. We're doing kinetics. Now, it's possible on the blackboard to show that if you have a cell and you apply a force to it, that on average the velocity of the cell is proportional to the force that you apply, at least if the forces are small. That's the justification for using this in a kinetic way. So there's a little derivation that you can do to do that. It's not a proof by any means. In particular, it's not a proof because that kind of little back of the envelope derivation assumes that interactions are local, and the moment you put in something like a volume constraint, you have non-local. So I think there's actually quite a bit of mathematics to do here if somebody wants to go and actually show that the assumptions that are made are valid. As I say, I spent years trying to get the diffusion constants right and get the relationship between the POTS parameters and the viscosity and surface tension, and my friends in Utrecht just went ahead and did the simulations. And I tell you, I'd rather be them. If people are interested in playing with this, we have downloaded it onto the Linux machine out in the hall. If you run Linux or Mac OS 10, you can download it yourselves. For some reason, besides not playing my movies, PowerPoint decided that it was only going to display these in yellow. You select it, you tell it to make them black, and they turn yellow again. So I'm sure no one can read it. These are places where you can download this code. To do the cell sorting simulation takes about 5 lines to 10 lines of HTML, of the markup language code. There is a book out there called, a little leaflet out there called Quick Start Guide to CompuCell 3D that walks you through how to use this and takes you through some of these simpler simulations. And Nico can walk you through the Lin-Hotroff and the condensation simulations and all that. So
you click the highlight in orange word. Click on the right mouse pad and then select to remove the hyperlink. and you prorate it in the blocks. It's hyperrated, prorated. It should be.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, the background blue.
Well, blue and gold are University of California colors. That's why.
Okay, so there at least people can read the places. Thank you.